For more than three decades, Dr. John Barge has been responsible for the revolutionary research into the unconscious mind, research that informed bestsellers like Blink and Thinking Fast and Slow. In his new book, Before You Know It, he takes us on a tour of the forces that affect everyday behavior while transforming our understanding of ourselves. Dr. Barge looks at how the unconscious guides our behavior, goals, and motivations in areas like race relations, parenting, business, consumer behavior, and addiction, and reveals what science now knows about the pervasive influence of the unconscious mind in who we choose to date or vote for, what we buy, where we live, how we perform on tests, and in job interviews, and much more. John Barge is a social psychologist and the world's leading expert on the unconscious mind, currently a professor of psychology at Yale University and director of the ACME Laboratory. Dr. Barge, a great pleasure to welcome you to the roundtable this morning. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, Joe. Pleasure to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. Tell us about the laboratory, first of all, and what it ultimately is doing when it comes to cognition, motivation, and evaluation.
Well, the nice thing about our lab, the fun thing about our lab is that we really, in some sense, don't have a lab at all in that we like to run these studies when people don't think they're being studied because, you know, we've all, or maybe some of us, have had the experience of being in these kinds of experiments and being very concerned about, doing the right thing or not looking like an idiot or you know, having this person evaluating us. And people usually are very much on their guard and self-conscious when they're in a psychology laboratory. And so what we'd like to do is to do things like measure what we're interested in when they don't think the experiment's even going on. For example, we have them hold a hot cup of coffee or a cold ice cup of coffee when going up to the lab, just incidentally, like, oh, here, trying to get their questionnaires for them, and could you hold this for me for just thank you and take it right back. And they don't think that's anything to do with the experiment. So by doing so, we get a better idea of what happens in real life, you know, when people aren't on their guard, when we're just being our normal selves without being so self-conscious. So in lots of ways, we like to do these studies not even really in a lab, sometimes leaving the lab or going into the lab or maybe in my office, sitting in my chair behind the desk versus the little student chair in front of the desk to look at the effect of power on somebody. And so by that way, we're more certain and confident that we can generalize to the real world.
What brought you to the book of looking at the unconscious reasons of what we do?
Back when I started, 1970s, it was an interesting time in psychology because we had, for a long time, behaviorism. B.F. Skinner is the most famous one, insisting that our conscious mind played no role at all in what we did. We were just being played by the outside environment, stimulus response, you know, like being played like a piano. And we had nothing to do with it. And so we had no freedom. We had no free will or anything like that. And then came what's called a cognitive revolution in that 1960s. Finally, psychology said, you know, to hell with that. We're going to study the conscious mind. We're going to study things like judgment and emotions and inside the person kinds of things for the first time. It's remarkable. It was only 50 years ago that this happened. And we started to have computers. We started to have electronic devices for the first time to study these things. And before that, we really had no actual science of what happened unconsciously. We certainly had Freud. Freud, studied with his case studies of his mental patients, basically, and generalized from those mental patients to what he thought was true of all of, you know, normal human nature and human psychology, but not scientifically. So what we did was to, for the first time, and labs around the world were doing this, looking at, well, what can be done by a person unconsciously? In other words, you don't need to intend to do it. You may not even be aware of doing it. But how many of the normal activities of daily life can be accomplished without your conscious mind operating them? And we started with little baby steps and just to see what we could find. And more, we found that a whole lot of things happen without our needing to consciously intend it to happen or monitor it. And that's what the book documents.
So a follow-up to a question, to an answer you gave just a moment ago, and the idea of holding the cup of coffee, of asking somebody to hold the coffee, what does that tell you? They don't realize you're doing it, but what does that tell you?
What happened in that study was a person held either something warm or they held the iced coffee, and then they went in and they read about a person and they said what the impression they formed of that person. They rated them on traits and said how much they liked that person. But everybody in the study read the same person. So everybody read the identical description of the identical person. The only difference between the groups was, had they just held something warm or something cold right before doing so? It turns out that if they had held something warm, they thought the person was more socially warm. They thought the person was more trustworthy, more generous, more understanding. And if they had held something physically cold, they thought the person was socially cold, that they were not trustworthy, they were not generous, they were selfish and had only their own interests at heart. And when we did that study, then neuroscience has come out since then, since the last 10 years, and actually shown there's an actual connection in a part of the human brain called insula, right in the middle. It's a walnut-shaped part of the brain right in the middle of our head. And there's an actual connection there between the area that lights up that responds to physical warmth and the one that lights up when responding to social warmth. For example, when you're texting to your family and friends or thinking about your close relationships, there's an actual physical connection there, a corollary one between cold, physical coldness, and when somebody betrays you, like takes your money in a game and doesn't give any back to you and betrays your trust or something like that. So what's remarkable here is that is actually instantiated in our minds all around the world, and it points to, through over-evolution, a channel that's there for infants, basically, that when you are a little infant and you're helpless and don't know anything about the world, you connect the fact that you're being held physically close and physically warm by your mother, let's say at breastfeeding, or maybe your father, but being held close when you're a little infant, that physical warmth is a cue, of a strong signal to the baby that you can trust the person who's holding you. There's a connection in their minds between feeling physically warm and trusting and bonding with the person that's holding them. And this leads to a wonderful thing that we can all and should do more of, you know, with our babies, with our infants, and even toddlers, is that hold them close and hug them so they feel your physical warmth, because there's a natural connection there in their minds between feeling that physical warmth and trusting you and feeling socially warm too.
So back to the coffee for a second, and just let me see if I understand this. When you give the coffee and it's warm, there is that feeling that that person is a warmer person, that that person is a friendlier person. How do we know that is our feeling, but how do we know the truth?
Right. This is the key of it, is that this is all dependent, and even in infants, this is dependent on reality. So, for example, that connection does not get made if the parent can't be trusted, if they're not there for you. So that connection between physical warmth and social warmth isn't there for children who didn't bond with their parents, who couldn't trust their mom or dad to be there for them. There's a thing called the Strange Test, which is a funny name, but they measure kids at 1 year of age by having them come in with their mother or father, and then they have the mother or father leave the room, and they see how the child reacts. And there's a whole kind of thing, a series of things they test on. And they can measure at age 1, 12 months, they can measure how closely attached is that child to their mother or father. Maybe you're not that attached. Maybe you're not bonded because that mother or father wasn't really there for you and doesn't respond when you cry and all that kind of thing. Well, then they followed these kids up. Now they're in their 20s, and they found that the more securely attached they were at age 1, the more friends they had in grade school, the more fun and happier they were and less depressed they were in high school, and the longer lasting their relationships are now. They have fewer breakups in their 20s. All of this was predicted by how closely attached they were at age 1 to their mom or dad. So it's not a guaranteed thing that when you land on planet Earth as a little baby that you're going to necessarily have, you know, caretakers, mothers and fathers who really are there for you. But if you do, that connection forms.
You have information on a remarkable study about, basically, you turned conservatives into liberals.
Temporarily.
Now, how do you do that even temporarily? Because, well, quite frankly, as long as that temporary state is during election day, right? That is,
yeah.
that's what makes a difference. Okay.
This is the one thing about Before You Know It is a lot of these things in the book are actually already known by advertisers and politicians and are being used. And this one, that people tend to be more conservative if they're more afraid or more threatened, that's been known for some time. It's not been a trick at all to turn liberals into conservatives. That's been done in laboratory studies, but it's been known for some time. But no one had ever turned a conservative into a liberal. And what we did makes a lot of sense once you hear what we did. We had them imagine that a genie had appeared to them and given them a superpower. And the superpower was either to fly, which is what we all, most people really want. I mean, I would want that if I got a choice of a superpower.
Right, sure.
But that was our control condition. The other one was to be totally physically immune from harm, that you were totally safe, like Superman. Bullets would bounce off of you, and you fell, nothing would happen, can't cut yourself. You're totally physically safe. And our people in our study imagined this really deeply and richly, you know, really got into it, closed their eyes and got into it. Afterwards, the people in the fly condition, the normal stuff. So on social attitudes and the opinion of social attitudes, conservatives were more conservative than liberals. It's no big surprise. On things like same-sex marriage, legalization of marijuana, the classic, you know, attitude issues that divide conservatives and liberals. But in the physical safety condition, once they imagine themselves to be physically safe, now conservatives were identical to liberals on these attitudes.
And when you say temporarily, is there a way of making it so it lasts longer, so it that it becomes permanent? There is an understanding?
You know, that's a wonderful follow-up. This is a study that's just coming out, just being published. I don't think it's online, but it's not actually out printed in the journal yet, so it's a new study. But, you know, it does open up the idea that, you know, given especially today when we're all sort of in echo chambers and we're, you know, watching the news that we like to watch, we're not really listening to the other side and not talking to each other very well, that it may be really useful to have these kinds of techniques or kinds of situations in which we start coming together a little more, that we might at least at that point, you know, be able to talk more, understand each other more. And I think that goes both ways. I mean, there's really good reasons for us to be nervous about our physical safety and worried about our physical safety and survival. Those are very adaptive kinds of things to be concerned about. You know, physical safety is our most important primal goal, to be safe and keep our loved ones safe. But at the same time, you know, there are reasons to be afraid. There are reasons to feel safe. And it's possible, perhaps, that if we can have everybody be afraid for a while, then maybe we'll understand each other on that level. And maybe if we do imaginations or actually realize how actually physically safe we often are in our lives, that we can come together in those terms. So it does open up a way. It does say, for one thing, that it is possible for us to be more similar and not to be just so hardened in our opinions.
You mentioned this a moment ago, that this is information in many cases that certainly ad agencies and politicians have known for quite a while of how we can be manipulated. Does giving us this information, does reading this book change that? Having that information and knowing what is going on, what impact does that have on the result?
I think it matters to the extent that if we want to be more in control and have our attitudes and our opinions, our votes reflect more of our, you know, own self-interest or the interest that we, our values, our deeply held values, because otherwise we are just going to be moved around fairly easily by people who know these levers and can pull them and push them. But it takes our wanting to do something different. It takes our wanting to take control back. So as I say at the end of Before You Know It, you know, we only have as much free will as we realize that we don't have our full free will, because to the extent we just think we do, we're just at the mercy of these kinds of influences. But if we realize how they're operating, we can take control back, and we can realize that, you know what, this is the usual October surprise right before an election where there's some scary thing and they're making us feel afraid because it tends to make us more conservative. We don't have to do that. We don't have to fall for these things. And Joe, I just want to point out, because there's another one that's actually a study done at Northeastern University Medical Center came out last year on teenage drinking, on children who are drinking before the legal age, like 13 to 19-year-olds. And what they found was the more alcohol ads that these kids see on TV, the more they drink. And so it's a direct line between what you see and what you do in terms of ads. And that's been known, you know, advertisers have known this for some time, that we tend to eat more when food ads are on TV, and we eat more at home, we consume more of the product at home. Well, then we have to buy more at the store the next day. The thing is, if we want to believe it doesn't affect us, that's our business. But when it affects our children, and it does, and this is a big study, you know, 1,000 teenage drinkers and the ones who saw alcohol ads on TV, which are fairly common, you know, sporting events. There's times when there's lots of alcohol ads on for things that you watch as a family. The kids who watched them drank 30, on the average, 30 alcoholic drinks a month. The kids who didn't, you know, who still drank some, were drinking like 5 or 10. So advertisers know that they can influence our behavior by these ads, and it's something we want to, you know, maybe think about and watch out for our kids.
The book is fascinating. It is titled Before You Know It, The Unconscious Reasons We Do What We Do. The book is published by Touchstone. John Barge, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you very much, Joe. Take care.
Thank you very much. Again, you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.